annual location event, such as you, for the fifth season. And we're also happy that Professor Silver has become a friend in the last few years, and that knows other pretty well. And in addition to giving us a scholarly perspective, he also is entertaining, but and it's difficult to speak to this Musa-ish about type of crowd because there are some who are somewhat beginners in his field of specialty and some are a little more advanced and some are advanced. But he's been doing a good job of it for the last couple of years that we know him. Professor Chaim Silber has been at Yeshiva University for over 20 years, teaching year in, year out, these subjects, one of which he's going to be speaking about this evening, about Yosef with the Egyptian background, based on what we know from the historical research that was done in recent centuries on Egypt, and the documents that were discovered, and so on. And some of you who have been Yeshiva University students know of his reputation. Some know his reputation for being a karate expert also, and he's been quite successful in that around the world. The Jewish Week had a whole page on him a few months ago, but it was focused more on the martial arts skills. But in any event, I'm just stalling for a couple of minutes, but we look forward to a continuing relationship. This is just another stop of Professor Silber here at Sephardi. Professor, I'm turning this over to you.
Emphasize some of the details and then get down to the business if you have any questions. What happens is like this. Here we have a boy who is born in Haran and died in Egypt while passing through Hebron. A perfect transitional man. Perfect man to lead our story from the Pharaoh's of Canaan to Moshe in Egypt, encompassing all of the culture of all three societies. Yosef is the last of the Haranim born, his brother Benjamin, of course, which means child of the south, the southerner, where you look east, the right hand of the south. Child was born in Canaan, and therefore south of Haran, so that the renamed, not the child of an affliction, but the southern Jew, the city of the south. And it is Yosef to whom Yaakov took all of this from. Let's discuss that for a moment. Mesopotamia, which is from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea, the highland between the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates, up to the Turkish frontier. The Syrian frontier, the divide, down the Jordan Rift, across the Jordan Sinai, stopping at basically Wadi El Arif, would be considered Mesopotamia. The cultures of Sumer, Babylon and Akkad are the prime civilizations of that time. Babylonian custom, law, language are primarily the underpinning of Sefer Bereshit. And in the more detailed lectures that are used occasionally at this school, as we get out, we discuss those underpinnings. For example, the story of the creation, the story of the flood, the various law codes, the various interplay between armies, the various interplay between rulers, all give Sefer Bereshit, right until this point in Rashi, which we finished today, a truly Mesopotamian underpinning. And to understand our Mesopotamian code, we must understand the Mesopotamian language. There is a desire by the clans to keep the genealogy within the Mesopotamian sphere. And therefore, even though Abraham and Yitzchak have come into Eretz Israel and Yitzchak has been living there for a long time, and there are girls within the clan that are living in Eretz Israel that could easily be wives for Yaakov, not only is he sent away to Haran to marry because of the fear of Esau, but also most likely if there was no fear of Esau and everything would come, we would feel that he would be sent back as the chosen son anyway to Haran to link up with the family again and to marry a Haranese girl. The word Haran where Haran means caravan stop or large road. And what happens is we have it in Israel too. We call it Anacharan Shari, which we call it Brooklyn King's Highway. And this is the central route of Israel, the middle. The word Haran is a caravan stop. And anyone who would be going between Eretz Israel and the Mesopotamian cities of Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, Syria, it stopped at Haran. And therefore the cultures of the entire Mesopotamian area would mix in Haran. And all of the major Semitic languages and dialects again mix in Haran. And therefore Haran, meaning caravan stop or naval depot, is an extremely important place and a very highly cosmopolitan place where caravans originate, and caravan rest and caravan terminate. The central clan of Terah, of Abraham, Soruk, Pabluk, Iber, and that group center primarily around Haran. And our tradition is one of northwestern settlements. And what happens is, Yaakov then lives in Haran and goes back to the land of his grandfather, learns his grandfather's customs, language, learns the genealogies, visits uncles and great uncles and cousins, and has this direct input in their lives, and they directly input into this. Yosef is born in the old country. For many, many years within the karate, I studied with a mainland Chinese, not in years, and was attached to many very, very wealthy Chinese households. One of the things that those people would do, the wealthier upper class people and very successful people, would take the children and send them back home, even though they stay here. Many times the parents would stay here because business is good. They'd take the children and send them back home to grandma. 10 years. In certain cases, they wouldn't see their children for 10 years or 11 years. Just by mail and phone, by the visit back home, and they brought the kids back and forth. Because they wanted the kids to be Chinese. And because they wanted the kids to be within the family back home from where the business came. And so the children were sent home to China. Either Taiwan or Hong Kong, or in some cases, when they were big with the politically strong enough, the mainland. And so that each of the children who would later inherit the business were thoroughly familiar with language, dialect, culture, and the relatives back home, because they had spent time there. And we see that our patriarchs did the same. And that it is Yaakov, when he comes back, and he refuses to call, and he deals with Laban, and he says, this is Gal-Ed. This is Gal-Ed. Then he, the minute he steps back into Eretz Yisrael, and the Malach preaches him into Eretz Yisrael, he speaks Hebrew. Once he leaves his grandfather's house, once he leaves the house of his mother, once he returns to Israel, he speaks Hebrew. Even though he is fully imbued with the old, he is back home, he is the son of Yitzchak. Yitzchak is an Israeli. Yitzchak never leaves Israel. And here is this Yosef, who is Karmi's born of an Israeli father and an Israeli grandfather, who now settles in Hebron. It is a very, very important aisle. Two. Let's discuss Yosef himself. Well, the Gemara in Yuma, 35a, calls him Tzadik. He is referred to as Yosef HaTzadik. And why? Nowhere in the text do we have a statement that would say, Vayvaber Hashem Yosef l'mor l'anem. And the Lord God spoke to Joseph, saying, or the Lord God came to Joseph in a dream at night and said. And yet, Joseph's natural action and his natural beauty and his natural righteousness are unbelievable. Unfortunately, when people see him, they are jealous of him, and sometimes they hate him, which is why the Medrash speaks and says, Yehuda is given the respect and everybody loves him, so he's given the Malupa. Otherwise, it would have easily been given to Joseph. Let's discuss that for a second. There are people in the Bible, and in Tanakh, all over, who are generally part and parcel of God. I'm not a theologian, I'm not a rabbi. However, I will tell you, as even as a professor of obvious people, a number of the major motifs within the story. And And what happens is this. What happens is this. His body shines and he's glistening. His face is lit up. The women are crazy and they get him into trouble all the time. And the Midrash Tanchuma recounts that Potiphar's wife invited all the ladies of the court and of the town to come and have lunch. And she gave each of them an esrog and a knife. And as they were pairing the esrogim, she called Yosef in. And when he walked in, all of the women cut their fingers with the knife. Because, as she reportedly was supposed to say, you cut your finger, you just looked at him once. I have to see him every day. This beauty, this inner life, this inner godliness, makes him, as we said earlier, Kitalech im Hashem. There are those people who, because of their essence, exude or are at one with God. And therefore, that kind of communication outside one-to-one is unnecessary. And Kabbalistically and from the point of view of motif of the ancient Near East, this gentleman exudes God's work all of the time. Physically beautiful, a genius, a managerial genius. Wherever this man goes, whatever he does, increase Yosef, Yehoshif, the Lord God increases this person and adds on to it. If he goes to jail, he becomes more than everything. Wherever he goes, he becomes the manager, the boss, the guy that straightens the books out, the guy that sees the IRS for the books, the guy that handles all of the stuff nobody knows about. He is this splendid creature. He has a problem. This splendiferousness causes him to be greatly envied by those people who see him. And it is this envy that causes him much distress throughout his career. And one of the reasons, as Mirab says, he is denied Malufa because of it. But Mashiach and Yosef is not denied. Again, he exudes this great, great righteousness. As an interpreter of dreams in the ancient Near East, this is extremely important. Dreams are done a number of ways. This is what you do. You dream things. Then you go to the local prophet, and they bring in a cow or a sheep, depending on how big the dream was, and how much money is that in the pot. And then slaughter the same. And then they cut the liver of this animal out. And they put it on the table. And then they look at it. They see the veins and the configuration of the liver, and when they see something interesting, right next to it they place a model of the liver in the form of a clay liver, and they divide the clay liver up into little sections, and they've got little flags. So they say, second section, upper corner, vein. And they put a little flag there. I'm trying to look for a picture of one of these livers for them. And then they... And then what they try to do is to get a series of flags in order. And they have a configuration. And then they take the liver, they look at it, they see the configuration of the flags, and based on other livers which they have read... Have you read that liver yet? I haven't. Great, let me read that. Be sure to read that. And they then make a diagnosis of the dream. These animals and these livers were brought to battle. Before every battle, Mesopotamian kings and Egyptian kings took these livers around and brought them with them. Here you see the shape of the liver, and that lump in the middle is the spleen for all you medicos out there. And there is the hole, there are the holes in the center. And under each of the holes, you will see a little bit of writing, and that will tell you what the omen is. when the vein in that area is too big, when there is a fold in the liver, when there is a discoloration in the liver. And since all of the humors of the body and all of the emotional ties are in your liver, therefore, when you have a dream, the best thing to do is to get an animal, put your hand on the animal's head, think about the dream, kill the animal, remove the liver, and read it. This will give you a surefire answer as to your, the upper one of my fingers, a surefire answer as to all of your liver needs. But don't let that get you down. If you're not a liver specialist, you can also do sheep entrails if you like, and also configurations of various birds. If you are good enough, you can simply estimate what the dream means and throw various kinds of chips or dice or pool or go out and find out what the dream. But to be the kind of person who can see a dream itself and interpret it without this kind of omen, this is the highest level. And only one or two people, or three people in the ancient Near East, that level of Jose, a visionary, an interpreter of dreams, can be reached. And therefore, Yosef plays a very, very important part. Right away, the kid is beautiful. Now, I grew up in the Bronx, in a fairly rough neighborhood, you know, 50 years ago. And if you were very smart, and you were very handsome, and you were a very good athlete, and you always got 100 on the test, you could get killed. And so what happens is that this is Yosef's major problem. And so he tells his brothers everything. And not only that, innocently, like I used to on my telltale on my sister and my brother-in-law when I was in the baby, young. So he goes back and telltales on his brother. And he is not possible. But Yaakov favors him. Because it is written that he is Ben Zikunin. Now we're going to stumble on right now at this point a very, very important motif that is in the Bible that doesn't really show up that much in the literature of the ancient Near East or Egypt. And that is the favoring of the younger, weaker son over the firstborn. If you are big and hairy, and you can fire a bow, and you can run down a venison, then chances are you are not the hero of our story. If you can barely lift yourself out of the tent, and that when you do lift yourself out of the tent, you are so pale that you have to be helped. And when you walk in the field, the only thing you do is babbling mincha. Then you are going to be a leader of Israel. A shining light and a bent toe. Any muscles whatsoever, any physical prowess whatsoever, any use of a weapon whatsoever, immediately places you on the back burner of history. This is a motif which is extremely interesting to all of us in the Bible living, and is one that exists in ancient Israel. We search for it very, very much in the literature of the Hittites, and of the Babylonians, and of the Sumerians. In other words, is the older son who by right and by law, they're all Semitic law, who must receive the first portion and the Yoresh and the inheritance. Is there anywhere outside of Israel that this happens? And the answer, except in one case, Hattashili the first passed over his oldest son and gave it to his younger son, evidently probably because the older one was incompetent. The thing happened, the same thing happened, of course, the king Hussein, Muhammad, and his father, and uncles, and everything. He became the king, there was nobody left. They could really do it. But other than that, even to the point where the concubine's children where Jacob's concubine children are passed over, where the younger of one concubine is passed over the older of the other. The same thing with regards to Shlomo HaMelech, when he is made king. The first point. What is this deal? In rabbinic theology, it is clear. The blessings of the tribes go in the order of the learning of Torah. Insofar as they are strong and learn Torah, then they are given the double blessing. Insofar as they are more physical, then they are given less. Early on, this occurs. And Yosef is given this status. First of all, he's Ben Zikunim. I want to discuss two or three things with this. And I'm looking at this little piece of paper so I don't speak about something else that I want to do. What happens is the following. Let's talk about wives and husbands. I don't wake you up anymore. Okay. First wife, second wife, third wife. Okay? Alright. Yeah? Good. What happens is like this. Many times the first wife, none of this, anything that I said, nothing to do with any of you or me. And the names have been changed to protect the innocent. What happens is like many, many times there is what we call a legal pedigree. There is the family, family A. They are very influential, very powerful, very wealthy. They speak for God, and in their ranks are very famous business people, very famous gangsters, and very famous presidents. A girl is born to them. First of all, the servants watch the intercourse. Secondly, the servants are present at the birth. The girl is marked by a band or, in some cases, by a tattoo. She is removed from her mother and given to the midwives and the nurses. 30 or 40 days later, I'm telling you some metaphor, 30 to 40 days later, the mother is committed to see him. She is then washed, like Shmuel Mishas Kitzir Amasavet, from Mina Hadrin Amahadrin, day and night, by large guys with big muscles who are not going to be trained. And she is her, the personification of her body and who she is. She is legal heir material. Meanwhile, 200 miles away, another part of the clan, there's another family, family B. And they are very, very wealthy, very powerful in the government and social things, and they have supported big temples and the priesthood, the members of the priesthood, members of the clergy, of course, members of the king, teaching in the Malukha, and members, of course, in the army. And the servants watch them, and intercourse, and that's recorded, and a boy is born from them, and the boy is recorded and taken, and this boy is placed on the star and this is born. As soon as the boy is born, a telex goes out from family A to family B. Dear Sam, I've just had a boy, let's talk. No? Two guys get together over lunch. And while slowly drinking tea and talking about old times on the frontier, they bring up the fact that they've got two heirs, legitimate heirs, intercourse witness, birth witness. We have to get these kids together so that we can have grandchildren who are the legal heirs to our lineage. And the arrangement is made early on. Right away, as soon as the birth happened. Then a very strange ceremony occurred. Officially, each father adopts as their own child the other's child. So that my daughter-in-law is also my real daughter. And again, vice versa. So that when Abraham says, my wife, my sister, he is not lying. He is Achotikala. He is not lying. Because adoption in the ancient Near East is not like adoption today, where the parents need to be deemed unfit by the court and then given to someone else for adoption or given up for adoption. A perfectly healthy family with a perfectly healthy kid who lives with a perfectly healthy family can be adopted by another perfectly healthy family for four or five different reasons. One reason is the one I gave you, that they are very, very important families, and in order for them to stay that way, it's happened. Why is that done? To protect them against divorce and to protect them against loss of family power. If the death occurs, God forbid, or there is a divorce, they are still related by the adoption. The families will still do business irrespective of whether the kids are physically together or not. Relationships in the ancient Near East are extremely important. And Sefer Bereshit takes up a lot of those very famous psukim that he spoke about, telling who is related to who and who is the son of who, so that we know the chatchila from the very beginning who we can do business with and under what terms and why. The genealogy is extremely important. Ezra does not leave Babylon until he finishes writing his genealogy. There is a tremendous amount of, tremendous rate of infant mortality in the ancient area. In the Far East, kids aren't even named for the first 2 years. They call them Heyu. And a lot of the Semitic names that we have also are names that are later titles. As we say in Hebrew, Kishmur Kenhu, as his name, son of the king. But these are later titles. Abiram, Abiram, my big daddy, Abraham. Well, we have it as a title in other languages. Is it a title or is it his name? And so what happens is that even names aren't given until later in life. Older children die quickly. Therefore, people who try to place a lot of faith in the young one, second or third one. Many times the first group did not make it. Also, there seems to be an intuition on the part of the other that whatever mistakes you make with the first one or two, you've ironed out by three or four. Oh, did I stop you? I have five. What happens is like this, and that is that, and the first one always has that shishupak vimi, that internal friction, which the Rabbanan does not like. The Rabbanan likes a more open, clear face, less militant, like this. But doesn't this cause tremendous friction within the family? Is passing over business all the time? Answer yes. And that is done, we believe, to cause that person to be hearted and to see if he can handle himself. Anybody who could take Am Yisrael and weave them through history is going to have to get by his older brothers first. And if he can get by his older brothers first, he can get by anybody. And it seems to be this motif that runs through. Let's leave this and move to something. There's a lot to be said to you. To go to question. As a sign of Jacob's love, he gives to Yosef kutonet pasir, which means, kutonet, of course, we translate today simply a shirt or an overgarment. Pasir we translate today as a stripe, a bar, a ribbon. I'm looking at this my thing. And what happens is that Kutonet Pasim is mentioned really only one other place, and you know it well, of course, 2 Samuel 13, verses 18 and 19. Ve'aleha kutolet pasim kichein v'shanna v'not ha-melech hab v'tulot v'ilim. And what this is, of course, the terrible occurrence of, in King David's household of brother Amnon and Tamar, and the rape, of course, of Tamar, and she flees after having been raped by her brother. She is identified because she wears that garment. And I went and I studied some of the ancient Near Eastern literature, which is fairly obvious in many, many places now, and I got the following thing. For such robes were the king's daughters, virgins, especially apparel. Children dressed alike in nobility. I must make a note for myself. Now, even European families, I don't have a Sephardic background, so you have to help me with this in the Sephardic country. But in Europe, boys were dressed as girls. In the privileged families, boys were dressed as girls. Little in these neuter outfits. My father was born in 1905. I have pictures that go back that far. All the kids, male and female, are dressed in this chalut, kind of general garment. The wealthier the families were, the more feminized the young boys are. Little female type sailor suit, long hair, big hat. And the dressing gown, very lacy, very frilly. In the nobility in the ancient Near East, in the Semitic group as well, they don't really allow them to be male until they reach almost bar mitzvah. Now whether that was a protection against the evil eye or against people who wish to usurp the dynasty, we don't know. But one thing is for sure, we have here the very, very famous Beni Hassan Kamhotep tomb that has a picture of 37 Asiatics as they came down to deal with Egypt. Here you see the standard dress. Look on top. In the tomb, in the tomb, the figures are 1 foot 6 inches high. You see it on top? Look at the garments that they're wearing. They are woolen kutonet pasim. But as you notice, they have no sleeves. And the Midrash says that the thing that delineated the garment of Joseph was that it was a full-length gown or robe, and that it had sleeves. The gown itself was to the ankle, and the sleeves were down to cover the wrist. Here you see the Semitic groups in their regular outfits. You see the brightly colored with the twisted thread, and they are sleeveless, and therefore a garment that would have these would be considered tremendously important and powerful. The fact that the virgins of the king's household under Melech David were dressed in these clothes indicated their purity. Yosef, Hatzadik, shining of face, glistening of body, pure of action, pure of speech, and one with God, would naturally have no problem wearing such a garment. As time goes on, Yaakov gives him more and more of these type of garments. In Japan, in China, in Egypt, it is extremely important that every time you receive a new title, you are given new lands, new wives, new accoutrements, and a ring or a chain of office, which we'll speak about later, and you are given clothing. Even those of you that probably saw the Shogun program on TV. Every time he gets promoted, they give him an extra wife and a new kimono. Right? So what happens is that this is extremely important. And therefore, this component pasim is reflected in the writings at a very important time. He is a dreamer of dreams. He is a managerial wizard. He is a version of spirit. And therefore the garment of divinity. All of these things, I would imagine, must have outraged the brothers to death. There is an article of clothing in the ancient Near East that we see mentioned in the annals of Ashurbanipal and before him Ashurnasipal. And this article of clothing is called a birmu. B-I-R-M-U, alert for the scrolling off. A birmu. A birmu is, again, a woolen garment, but it has, at the end of it, a band. A pas is also a band or a ridge. It has five or six layers, which would cause a 3 to 5 inch band. And the chaluk itself, the jalabiyah itself, is solid. But the pas that runs along it has 5 or 10 different colors that are intertwined, and that these is very, very gaily colored, and is also called, would be translated in Hebrew as kutonis pasim. And we see that Ashurnasipal II, in his annals, says that the 200 females, the 200 unmarried females of his court, wore this garment. Later on in the annals of Ashurbanipal, he gives this garment as a present when he promotes the Egyptian puppet ruler Necho to be the vassal, to Egypt's vassal to him. He gives him this garment as a symbol of the trust between the two of them. And that is extremely important. Again, the same way that upon the promotion of someone, they are given these new garments. Let's talk about his righteousness. Here is a Pritchard's Ancient Near Eastern text, and we have the following. In this story, this is the story of two brothers, Anubis and Babis. This is an Egyptian story. Everyone in Egypt knows this story. We spoke about it in our lectures, in the private lectures that we have. This is a very, very old story of two brothers who are given the names of God. The younger brother is unmarried. He is a tzaddik. He is glistening. He is beautiful to behold. The older brother is a good guy. Their parents are dead. The older one takes care of him. He works for his older brother. And he is so pure, the Kappas speak to him. And they say to him, let's go to the pasture number 6. The grass is best there, and that's where we like it. And he takes them there. And so they eat the best, they look the best, and they have the best quality offspring, and the flock growing, growing, growing. One day, he's in the field, and the older brother runs out of seed, double meaning joke there, and he says, go back to the bin and pick me up a big jug of seed. The Egyptian jugs at that time have a pointed end, and a rounded top, and two loops. There's another joke there. And it has such a humor, isn't it? And sometimes, you know, the funny thing in Tanakh is that sometimes we don't know it. And you'll see the guy read the talk and say, the chicken crossed the road to get to the other side. You know, sometimes we don't realize that what's going on in the museum and other places is a diatribe against the king or something, and they're really giving it to him, you know. And, you know, we just gloss over and take it pretty seriously. But what happens is, again, this was a good time story. Everybody knew this. And the older brother's wife, who is a very pretty lady, is doing her curls. You know, they shave their heads, they can take themselves some gnats and stuff, and they wore the wig. And she looks out the window and she says, my goodness. And upon looking out the window, she sees her brother-in-law and she says, his body is glistening and wonderful. The strength of a god is in him. How much is that you're holding on your shoulder? He says, 3 emmers of wheat, 1 emmer of barley. Then she said to him, how much is that on your shoulder? And he said to her, quote, 3 sacks of emmer, 2 sacks of barley, 5 in all. That is what is on my shoulder. And so he spoke to him. Then she talked to him, saying, quote, there is a great deal of strength in you. Now I see your energy every day. That made it sound familiar? Well, British Museum 1860, but it goes back very, very, very early, the earliest dynasty, maybe second, third dynasty, which is, 1,000 years before we came to the place of Joseph. The place of Joseph is around 1500, 1750. When Joseph gets to Egypt, the story is 1,000 years in preparation. It is a standard. It is a standard. Oh! I should have brought the slides with me. I see where this group's going. I know exactly what to talk about now. I don't know how to do it. Okay. How much is that? And 3 seconds. He spoke to her. Then she talked to him, saying, quote, there is a great deal of strength in you. Now I see your energies every day. And she wanted to know him as one knows a man. Then she stood up. Then she stood up and took hold of him and said to him, quote, let us spend an hour sleeping together. Explanation. This will do you good. Don't do it for me. Do it for you. This will do you good because I shall make fine clothes for you. Which means you will be promoted. Because fine clothes and the giving of new clothes, a new garment, is a symbol of social elevation. Sleep with me on the horse's wife. This will be good for you. Then the lad became like a leopard with great rage at the wicked suggestion which she had made to him. And she was very, very much affrighted. And then he argued with her, saying, see here, you are like a mother to me, and your husband is like a father to me, because being older than I, he was the one who brought me up. What is this great crime which you have said to me? Do not say it to me again, and I won't tell a single person, nor will I let it out of my mouth to any man again. And he lifted up his load and went to the field. And then he reached his brother, and they were busy with work. The wife of the elder brother was afraid because of the suggestion she had made, and she took fat and grease and became one who was like a woman who was criminally beaten and wanting to tell her husband, quote, it was your younger brother who did the beating. And so she does not light a light in the house, and she does not cook food, and she smears her face with her makeup, and rips her garments and lays on the bed, and when hubby comes home, she says, your brother got more from the bin than that emmer of wheat you sent him. And the rest of that will have to be another time. But you see there is a motif going on here, is there not? Not to say that the story of Yosef did not happen with Potiphar, because whenever there are servants in the house, whenever there are strong men and strong women, the men are fair game for the woman landlord, the women are fair game for the man. It's an old, old motif. But it is an Egyptian motif for one who is extremely righteous, for one who is extremely competent, for one who is like a god in his strength, like a god in his beauty, but does not use this beautiful face or body for its worldly advantage. And Yosef is this guy. So that when the Egyptians know about this story, this Potiphar's wife, and I'm sure later when he becomes head of the granaries of Egypt, he's totally exonerated, he becomes the classic wronged tzaddik. In other words, at the time it's very, very dark for him. And he's thrown into jail. But in later life, building his reputation, probably the best thing that ever happened to him. as far as the establishment of his reputation as Tzaddik. And every Egyptian understands that because it's basic Egyptian literature as well. Okay? And again, the use of the garment there to be used as an elevation. How much time is this? Okay. But otherwise, it's okay. It went to tomorrow. Okay. Now, what happens is like this. Now, let's talk about, so what happens is at 17, he is sent by his father to take the flock to Dothan, which is Dayton, Ohio. And the funny thing is that, you know, the locative hay in Hebrew is Ah, Mithraima, you see, Dothana. So we have both in the Pesukim, Dothana and Dothan. So the Americans, you know, Bible scholars made Dayton, Ohio for Dothan and Daytona Beach, Florida for Dothana, you know, not realizing it's the same place. But what happens is, so Yosef is sent to Dothan to look after his brother's sheep. Now let me tell you something. The motif of the Tzaddik is a person who cares for someone else's sheep. A shepherd who cares for someone else's sheep. This is again Moshe Rabbeinu being the shepherd of the flocks of his father-in-law, Yitro. And the paradigm example of great righteousness again is this guardian of the flocks of his father. And he sends out to look and see how his brothers are. The minute they come and see him, they hate him right away. Now what happens is, what we do in our business is the following. You tell us that the caravan of Ishmaelites / Midianites pass through Dothan and pick up this kid. The first thing that we say to you is this a really a viable route? Is this the way caravans go? And it so happens that it is exactly the way caravans go. As a matter of fact, going north, they would go Hebron, Beit Lechem, Beit El, a place called Levona, Shem Dothan, and then on the way to Syria. Here is, in the blue line, the very route taken by the caravan into Dothan. Dothan is here, my finger. The red line was there be the route taken by the caravan after they leave Dothan to go to Egypt with Yosef, as you see. Here you have the journeys of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and you see the lines are parallel because the patriarchs basically take the same line. Yes, it is the line of the watershed, exactly. It is the line of the watershed. And again, it is not until the Romans, with regards to architecture, where the Romans totally disregard the topography, and they make their aqueducts go over mountains and through valleys, etc. And where there's a valley, they simply fill it in. All other people, until the Romans, basically follow the natural configurations of the land. And therefore highways wind their way through the watershed areas, wadis, etc., and the crest of the various mountains. And so one of the questions that we ask historically is, if he was sold at Dothan to a caravan of Ishmaelites or Midianites who were traveling with Ishmaelites, or whatever the combination is, then is this possible? The answer is 100% yes. This is the natural caravan route, as it would stop again through Dothan. So, also, what would they be carrying? They would be carrying laudanum. They would be carrying turquoise ground into a paste used for eye makeup. They would be carrying some of that beautiful blue tint of the murex off the Lebanese coast. They would be carrying the balm of Gilead and all the different salves that were made for medical purposes, medicinal purposes, in the northern Canaan. And they would also be carrying fine woven garments as well. And so this group of people would be on their way through Dothan, and evidently what they would do is they would pass through the Beit Shan Valley. Later on, when the Egyptians reconquer Israel, which we'll think about a little bit later, Beit Shan is a major important spot for them. They hook up the coast and they hook over to Beit Shan. And there is an Egyptian outpost in Beit Shan very, very, very early, second millennium. And the Egyptians try to hold Beit Shan as much as possible, because it is through Beit Shan that the caravans come. And therefore, caravan carrying these Ishmaelites, Midianites, will come from Beit Shan and down to the Dothan area. Let's talk about some of the titles. He enters the house of Potiphar, and which we know is a title which is very, very, very common. Potiphare, which means the Lord, that whom the Lord God has given. Actually, his name is Nesoneh, which is exactly what we would, in Ashkenazi, you know, Nathanael is Nesonu, and that is, and Potiphar, Potiphyara, that the Potiphyara, basically, the Potiphar is an abridged or apocryphated form of Potiphyara. And what happens is it's a very, very common name, a very, very common title, and a very common title of the period. Also, he is called Sar HaTavachim, chief cook. And let me just tell you two things about chief cooks and cupbearers. Cupbearers and chief cooks in the ancient Near East and in Egypt have nothing to do with the kitchen. They have to do with the military and with the judicial system. I am cupbearer to the king. I pass him the cup. He is like saying, he is like King David saying, he is the footstool of God. He is not physically walking around with an upholstered back. It means he is his emissary. He is his representative. And what happens is the following. Some of the Tabachim we know from the inscriptions of Ramses III was a person who was the head of the Supreme Court. So these descriptions are throughout. Also the destruction of Yerushalayim, Rav Shaqet, again discussed or described as Sar HaTavachim. He makes a joke about Tuvachim that he is a slaughter. But what happens is, and this has nothing to do with cooks also, what happens is this, in Chinese is that a grand master of the martial arts is called Da Shu. A grand master teacher is called Sher Fu. Da Sher Fu means chief cook. So what happens is, the Chinese do the same deal. The biggest grand master that they could consider is the chief cook. Well, because it means the person that sustains something. Also, when you are a jack of all trades in English, you say, I am chief cook and bottle washer to the king. In other words, I handle all the affairs. And the cooking is always used on, and actually, Sar HaTavachim, as a useful Potiphar, actually means head cuisinier. And it has the feeling of sustenance to sustain something. I don't think he ever saw the inside of the kitchen in his life, or that the cupbearer who has the dream. You see, this is the thing. When Joseph says to the cupbearer of the king, "Remember me when you leave here, that I interpreted this dream for you." He knew that he had the ear of Pharaoh, because he was one of the people who was a justice. Also, there's a Ramses the Third is hydrophobic. Ramses the Third is murdered. You have to look by the way. There was a trial. And the judges, two of the judges, by the way, have Northern Semitic names. But they are called cupbearers. The judges are called cupbearers. So there is a very, very important play that's going on. Let's discuss just 1 second, because we're running out of time, and there's so much to say in different areas about the historiosity of the Jewish story. And I want to leave some time, if you have any questions, the following. There are a number of interesting connections that follow. First thing that we do is we look for a picture. I knew this was my question. No, not really. Not moving. Again, I'm a question preacher, a big red girl, so I know about this. Don't be a guy. Just move on. Okay, so look. What happens is like this. We're looking for a time where this whole thing could have happened. One of the things that we do is we try to find a setting. Nothing happens out of the historical context. There, things are going on. Most scholars and people in the know try to put the period of the Hyksos, which we spoke about a lot in our lectures here, as the background time for the story of this day. Something very, very interesting. You know, in Sefer Bamidbar, in Bamidbar Yud Gimel, in the 13th chapter of Bamidbar, verse 22, it says that Hebron was founded 7 years before Tzoan, which is the Hyksos time. They're referring to Hebron as Kiryat Arba, and they were supposed to mention that it was founded 7 years before Tzoan. There are two major connections. One, why Tzoan? Tzoan is Tanis. You know it is where it is the Lost Ark City. It is the capital in northern Gaza of the Hyksos people who come in. Also, there is a 7 years, this place again. 7 years.